Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 183. And last time, at the end of the lesson, we were in Genesis chapter 31, speaking about and discussing the fleeing of Jacob from his father-in-law. And obviously the way he did it is in a manner so Laban would not even know about it. And it's very interesting the terminology that we see here. And verse 19, we read that Rachel, on her part, as we read here, now Laban was gone to shear his sheep, so they waited for that. And obviously, when that happens, people are very busy, and they're not aware of what's happening anywhere else. And so they, in essence, were plotting and doing that in a deceitful manner, at least from that point of view, on the part of Laban. And Rachel stole the teraphim, which were basically the figurines, you know, that were used, the small ones that people could carry with them, and they basically represented the deities that people worshipped, Elohim, that is a false Elohim. Some people think the word Elohim or God is, God that came later on, but the word Elohim, they think that it is a holy word or holy name that is applicable only to the God of heaven or the Elohim of heaven. But the word Elohim basically means deity. And as God said, even in the first commandment, you know, you shall have no other Elohim beside me. So he's Elohim, and also others were also called Elohim, in other words, deity. Now the other deities obviously are false. They cannot function, they cannot produce anything, and they're not really Elohim. In the true sense, they're not really deity, what a deity should be. Anyway, she stole the teraphim for different reasons. One is to deprive, obviously, Laban, her father, from seeking help in trying to capture Jacob and bringing harm on him. And on the other hand, also her own superstitions and her own background in upbringing, which was not basically totally godly, in the sense of worshipping only the true God, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, because there was a mixture there. Though they knew about the God of Abraham, the true God, and that was the reality in Babylon, they all knew about the true God, but they also had many other gods. And so it was a mixture of both, and you can see that throughout the entirety of the house of Israel, they did not see anything wrong about worshipping the true God of creation, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also worshipping all the other gods. They, in essence, harmonized the two, and they did not see anything wrong about it. And that would explain when you understand how is it that a people that had known God, that had known him in terms of all that he had done for them, and when he brought them out of Egypt, also turn away to other gods. Well, that was the attitude of people for generations. They did not see anything wrong between harmonizing the true God and all the others. They thought, there is the supreme God above all, and then what later on we call demigods, and they are in charge only of certain areas of creation, and so to them it was not a strange idea. Now, later on, when people became basically in the Christian world, the Muslim world, and obviously before that, the world of Israel, and then became later on only the Jewish world, they believed in monotheism in terms of only one single divine being, which was not correct either anyway, because there are two of them. And then looking back at this, I think, well, that's very strange. How can people worship so many gods? Well, to this very day, it's still practiced. The Far East. Anyway, that was the background of Rachel. So she, on her part, she stole the Elohim or the Teraphim of Laban. Now, what is it that Jacob did? In verse 20 we read, and Jacob outwitted Laban the Aramean. Well, outwitted does not explain the Hebrew terminology here, and so you miss something in the translation. The word in Hebrew is vaygnov, in other words, Vaygnov Yaakov et Lev Lavan, which means, and Jacob stole the heart of Laban. Well, in English, it just translated what it means. He outwitted him. In other words, the terminology used in Hebrew explains to you the idea of what you go through when you deceive someone. You see? And so this descriptive terminology basically tells you that you are, in essence, it's as if you have stole someone's heart. You see? And it's very interesting that, as you read here, Rachel, his wife, stole the Elohim of Laban, while Jacob, her husband, stole the heart of Laban. So in essence, both of them were robbing him of his power, you know, supposed power in his God, and of his heart, you know, in essence, the heart with which he thinks and knows and is aware of what is happening. So very interesting to see it that way. And so you see this terminology, to steal someone's heart. And in essence, what happens is when people deceive other people to believe that they are what they really are not, or to believe that they do, or to believe that they say what they really don't mean, the Hebrew terminology basically makes it very plain. This is stealing. And you know the law, one of the Ten Commandments, is against stealing. There is no law against outwitting, but there is a law against stealing. And so when you steal someone's heart, and that could be in many ways, you know, there are a lot of men that deceive women to believe that they love them, and they really don't. You know, they just want to get something out of them, or, you know, be it sex or anything else. And they don't think that it is wrong. Or, you know, we deceive by nature many others. We have a deceitful nature, and we deceive all the time without even realizing. And we think, oh, well, I just outwitted him. And we don't realize the depth of that action the way God sees it. God tells us, you don't steal. Now, of course, there are areas where it's not wrong to do that. You know, in other words, you have to understand that you have to be shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove. You know, don't have to tell everything to everybody. So in that sense, you're stealing someone's heart. But it's not with a malicious intent. So obviously it was not a malicious intent on the part of Jacob. Nevertheless, the terminology is still the same. You steal somebody's heart. And so it's very interesting to see it recorded in that manner. And so Jacob outwitted, in English, that's what you read here, translation, Laban, the Aramean, and in that he told him not, that he fled. You see? So in essence, he pretended like everything is as usual, nothing's going to happen, so he was deceiving him in that sense. Now, that kind of deception is not necessarily the evil kind of deception, because there are other kind of deceptions which are not the same. And in either case, generally speaking, our character, we should be above board. But there are times where you don't have to say everything. No more than, you know, when God told Moses, you know, you go tell Pharaoh, well, you know, we just want to go into the wilderness for 3 days. You see? Well, obviously, that was not the intent. So, in essence, God was the one there stealing the heart of Pharaoh, and he was telling Moses to do that. And he'd done it several times, you know, like when he told Samuel, you go anoint David, but, you know, Samuel said, oh, no, he's going to kill me if he hears about it, you know, I can't do that. And God said, well, don't worry about it. Just tell him that you are taking a sacrifice, and you're going to have a sacrifice there with the highway in Bethlehem. That, in a sense, was stealing the heart of Saul. So you have to understand when stealing is wrong, and when stealing is just the usual concept of just outwitting someone. You did all the time in every area of life, you know. And so I have to understand one from the other. In other words, when we study the Bible, we always have to have wisdom, the wisdom of God, because some people look at that and says, well, there was something wrong here with Jacob, or there's something wrong with God for saying that. Well, the wise does understand, and the unwise, unfortunately, they don't know how to make a difference between the holy and the profane. This was not a profane attitude on the part of Jacob. This was a matter of being as shrewd as a serpent and harmless as a dove. And that's the key. When you're shrewd as a serpent and when you outwit some people, make sure you're also harmless as a dove. So you don't do that in order to harm a person, you see. And some people forget that. and both outwit people, in other words, steal their heart, and also they harm them by it. And this is what the prohibition is. You can be shrewd as a serpent, but don't be harmful. And so this is what Jacob had done here. And so he fled with all that he had and rose up and passed over the river, speaking about the Euphrates, because he was between the rivers. That's what the name of it in Hebrew, the land between the rivers, also Aram Naharaim. In other words, Aram is Aramean territory there that later on became known as Syria, and then which actually was Babylon, but later on became known as Syria. Of course, when you read it in English, you read Syria, but when you read it in Hebrew, the land that is known today as Syria is called Aram. Still, to this very day, people, when they refer to that territory in biblical terminology, they call it Aram, they don't call it Syria. That's something that came later on by the Greeks. And so he's going toward, he says, he set his face toward mountain of Gilead. Now, there was no such a place, mountain of Gilead. There was a mountain, but was not called Gilead, or Gilad in Hebrew. In Gilead, you lose the meaning of what it means. It's Gilad, or Galed, as originally was named, and that would come later, as we shall see here. But, obviously, Moses is writing it, and after the facts, and so he's in essence calling a place that was not called yet by that name. And so we read in verse 22, and it was told Laban on the third day that Jacob was fled. So now he has 3 days. See, for 3 days, you know, Laban is pretty occupied with shearing the flock. And so now, in essence, he has 3 days advantage over Laban. 3 days he can cover quite a territory, even though you have a great entourage with you and animals and things like that. So he had a 3 day head start. And verse 23, and he took his brethren, that is, you know, his brethren, that's a general terminology, all those who were with him, and he pursued him, and after 7 days' journey, in essence, he just overtook him. So he pursued after him 7 days' journey, and so that added to the 3 days, they have 10 day period. And by this time, Jacob made it all the way from the river Euphrates into the land of Canaan, that became, you know, on the east bank, that is, of the Jordan River. So it took him 10 days, in essence, from that point, from Babylon, from north, you know, Babylon, northern Babylon, northwest, you might say, Babylon to the land of Canaan on the east side of the Jordan. In an area where he, in essence, was stationed for the night, and this is where he overtook him. And that's by the Yabok River, and that's a place where later on he was going to struggle or wrestle with the angel, which was God himself. While back, I believe about 2.5 years ago, I think, I was right at this very spot on the Jordan side of this area, and was looking at that very river. Very interesting, you know, you look at it, it's nothing special. But the way the faith is, that it's not what you see. You see, it's invisible. And so if you just close your eyes, you can go back into that period of time, almost 3,800 years, and you can witness, in essence, knowing the account, what really happened at that time. So that makes it very momentous. Anyway, this is where he overtook him, in the mountain of Gilead. And then verse 24, now something happens here, because God knows what was going to happen. He knew what was in the heart of Laban. You see, he was going to be so furious and so angry and so mad. Maybe or maybe not, he was going to kill Jacob for doing that. But at the least, he would have taken him captive, and, you know, all of his daughters and everything else, and take them, you know, he would have taken them back to his own land. Because, you see, legally he could have done it. It's in accordance with the law. As long as he is alive, the father is in possession of everything. You see? His sons belong to him. Their property belongs to him. Their children belong to him. That was the nature of things at the time. Of course, nowadays things are different. And so what he was doing here, basically, was, humanly speaking, legal. But God intervenes here. And God came to Laban, that is, Elohim came to Laban, the Aramean. There's constantly, you know, this mention, Laban the Aramean. And in a dream of the night, and say to him. And oftentimes when God wanted to protect his people, and that happened several times, and we have many mentions like that, when he wanted to protect Abraham from Pharaoh, he came to Pharaoh by night in a dream, and he spoke to him. And Pharaoh didn't say, "Who are you? You know, I never heard of you." You know, all of them, the whole world at the time, knew about the Supreme God. You see? And so when God came to them, they knew who he was. They didn't worship him. They didn't know his nature and character, obviously, but they knew him. They knew about him, at least. And so he did it with Abraham, and did it with Abraham again, with the king of the Philistines, Abimelech, and then later on with Isaac, was the same. He came to Abimelech in a dream, and he warned him. And so you see many times where it happens like that. God oftentimes communicates with people, and not only Israelites. Obviously, here we were talking about Laban. Pharaoh was not an Israelite, and Abimelech was not, and the prophet was not an Israelite. Some people think that God speaks only to Israelites. All the patriarchs up to Abraham, well, none of them was an Israelite. So God has a relationship, at least to a degree, with people on the face of the earth, and I'm sure he does to this very day. Only we're not aware of it, and we think he deals only with us. You know, that shows ignorance on our part. God is the God of the whole earth. He's not the God of only one people or one group. It's, you know, it's people who appropriate God to themselves, and that shows their blindness and ignorance, and they do not show much understanding of the God of heaven. And so, this is what God says to him. Take heed to yourself that you do not speak to Jacob either good or bad. In other words, just shut your mouth when you go there, and don't you dare do anything. You see, I mean, there is nothing wrong about saying good about the person, but what he means by that, you know, it's an idiom. In other words, keep your mouth shut. In other words, don't do anything. Don't you dare do anything against him. And that's in essence what the idiom is used for. When they mean don't do either good or bad, just hands off. And that's in essence what he told him. And obviously he knows who this God is, because his fathers worshipped that God. He himself, you know, to a degree, has information and knowledge of this God, and he fears this God. And also he has the other gods. And you see, and they did not think that it was a contradiction. That's how ignorant people were, and that's the reason why the children of Israel, you know, they didn't see any problem with creating the golden calf and calling it, you know, the God that brought them out of Egypt. They did not have that clear understanding as Abraham did, as the faithful, like Noah and all the other patriarchs, that only the God that dealt with them is the true God, and all the others are not, and therefore they should not be worshipped. They lost that understanding as time went by. And so this is what God says to him. And Laban, verse 25, came up with, that is, Laban came up with Jacob. In other words, he came to the place where Jacob was camping for the night. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountain, and Laban, with his brethren, and all those who came with him, pitched in the mountain of Gilead. In other words, it was an area that was mountainous, and when you go over there, you see, in essence, you know, what they call mountains there, or, you know, we call hills here. And they were basically hills. And obviously, Laban is behind one hill, and Jacob is on the other side of the hill, sort of hiding from each other. And so the name where Laban pitched his tent later on became known Galed. And we're going to see that pretty soon. And so we read in verse 26, and Laban said to Jacob, you know, he camped over there, and then he came over, and he speaks to Jacob, "What have you done that you have outwitted me?" In other words, that you have stolen my heart, you see, and carried away my daughters as though captives of the sword. Now, this was not true. And Laban should have known that. But you know, that's the description that he used here, showing that he was, filled with anger and fury, that he was not even thinking straight to even think that Jacob would do that. But, consider the background that the father owns everything, and anybody who takes away, the property without the permission of the father, it's as if he went to war, you see, against the patriarch, and that's the reason why he's describing it in this manner also. Wherefore did you flee secretly and outwitted me? In other words, you stole me. That's a word to use in Hebrew. In other words, you stole my heart. And you did not tell me that I might have sent you away with mirth and with songs, with tabret and with harp. And obviously that was not really his intent. You see, he was so greedy, and he was not allow the, in essence, the goose that lays the golden eggs, which Jacob was to him, go free. You see, he had too much use for him. No more than Pharaoh later on was about to allow the children of Israel go free. So you see a similar situation here. In essence, Jacob, because of that law, was in essence captive. You see, because as the law was even later on, the law that God gave his people, he basically told them, look, if you go and become a slave or a servant to someone else, and you are with him and he gives you a wife, if you want to go free later on, well, it's up to you to make a decision at that point, because if you go free, you're not going to be able to take your wife and children with you that would belong to the master. You see, so that was not only a custom of the land, that was in essence later on what God even injected into the law that he gave his people. And obviously those laws were not new, they were from the beginning of time, so many societies knew about that. That the master owns everything, and if the slave wants to go free, when the time comes to go free for whatever reason, which to begin with, the non-Israelite nations did not send their slaves free, but if for whatever reason the slave went, by buying his own freedom, left the master, he could not have taken the wife that was given to him and the children that came from it, because all those were considered to be the property of the owner. And so in essence, that's what he's saying here, which is not correct, because he was really in essence speaking deceitfully here, that he would have sent him away with songs and tabret and harp, and Jacob knew it very well, he was not going to do that. And so Laban understood very well why he fled secretly, because he himself was not above board and was not honest. And so he says, why did you do that? Because I would have sent you with mirth and songs and with tabret and with harp, and you did not suffer me to kiss my sons and my daughters. In other words, have a family separation the way it should be done when people want to go different places. But you even prevented me from doing it, which in essence he did, but it was because of the evil on the part of Laban, and not because Jacob wanted to do it this way. He would have preferred otherwise. And so he says, now you have done foolishly. It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt. You see, he had a lot of servants with him, so he could have inflicted him, obviously, with hurt. But the God of your father, he didn't say the God of our father, you see, because his father, Nahor, who was the brother of Abraham, knew about this God. But they were not as adamant and were not as clear in their knowledge and understanding as Abraham knew that all the others that they worshipped were not gods, and only the true God is the only God, and therefore he's the only one to be worshipped. So he, in essence, made that departure in contrast to the rest of his family from this concept that, yes, there is a God of heavens. And when you study paganism and idolatry, and you realize that was their concept. There is a God of gods, and the Greeks called him Zeus, the God of gods, and then all the other gods. Well, Abraham was the first one in the family that he knew, yes, there is a God of gods, but he's the only God, and all the others are not. And so he's saying the God of your father, Abraham, and if he was honest, and clear, and spiritually sane, he would have said, our God, the God of our fathers, but he says the God of your father spoken to me yesterday night, saying, and he knew that he was God, and he knew that he's the supreme God, the creator. And he says, take it yourself that you speak not to Jacob either good or bad. So obviously he feared him, knowing that he is truly a God, a true God. And now that you are surely gone, because you sore longs after your father's house, wherefore have you stolen my gods? He says, well, I understand that he needed to go. By what? Why did you have to steal my gods? I mean, you want to go, you go, but why do you need to steal my gods? You've got your own God. Why did you steal my Elohim? You know, you've got your Elohim, I've got my Elohim. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, now at this point Jacob is not aware of the fact that somebody in his family stole the gods of Laban, so he's not even replying to this question. But the reason why he left, he said, Jacob answered and said to Laban, because I was afraid, for I said, lest you should take your daughters from me by force. And by legally he could have done it. With whomsoever you find your gods, he shall not live. And that statement was a very, very dangerous statement in essence. Just like some people said in those days, they don't use that terminology anymore, you know, as the Lord lives or as whatever, you see, or as I live, I'm going to do this and that. And if they were lying, penalty will be incurred. You see, so here, his statement that came out of his mouth became a reality. And the person that did steal the gods did die, and that was his own wife. At this point, he did not even know it. Had he known it, obviously he would not have said that. But in essence, you can see how God is working here within the family of this people, and the damage, in essence, that Rachel had caused to the family, the whole family of Jacob, because later on you find them is still holding to those gods and worshipping those gods along with the God of their father. So she, in essence, was perpetuating idolatry in Israel, and the penalty for that was death. And so, in essence, you might say Jacob was inspired to even make this statement, and God is not a respecter of persons. And so, this is what he's saying here, and God, in essence, you might say, was the one inspiring it, and then he brought it to pass. But not before his plan was finished. In essence, the plan that was to bring forth out of Jacob 12 sons. You see, because the last one that Rachel gave birth to was Benjamin, and at that moment, when she fulfilled her commission in that sense in this lifetime, in the plan of God, because Benjamin was also needed as another of the patriarchs, whose name will be over one of the gates, not only in the Jerusalem that Jesus Christ will reign over, but also the Jerusalem above that will come down from heaven and will also have the name of Benjamin on it. So you can see, you know, from the point of view of God, as we know the whole story, we can put all those things together. So it's not a coincidence, all these things. At the moment when you see it, just like when you see a movie, you see all kind of things and you don't see any relevance there. From one detail to the other, and then only when you come to the end of the story you can put all those things together, and that's in essence the way the screenwriter is planning it. And so you can see here the screenwriter of all men's history is in essence giving you an awful lot of details, and if you just look at those details, and they don't make sense oftentimes, but when you see the entirety of the story, then you can say, oh, now I understand. And that's in essence what you see here also. And so we read, this is what Jacob said, the person that had done it will not live, and that person did not. And before our brethren discern you, again, that's a general terminology, that means all of us, yours and mine, that is our people, that's a general terminology, everybody's called a brother. Discern you what is yours with me and take it to you. In other words, what is yours in the sense of the gods, not what is yours in the sense of his wives and children and all the flocks that he gained, because that by divine law was his. By human law it belonged to Laban. So it's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the gods. And so Laban, now notice something interesting here. Verse 33, and Laban went into Jacob's tent. Why is it called Jacob's tent? You study biblical life, and you realize that the husband had his own tent, the wife had her own tent, and if he had multiple wives, every single one of them had her own tent, and, you know, for physical needs, and also, that helps also with spiritual, that is, with fellowship and communication, and, you know, relationship, it helps for each one to have her own place, her own tent, otherwise it creates frictions. And so this is what you see there. He goes into Jacob's tent, and into Leah's tent, and into the tent of the two maids, you know, each one of them, you know, the two wives now, maidservants, still called maidservants, but they're wives. But he found them not. And he went out of Leah's tent and entered into Rachel's tent. So each one of them has her own tent, and that was a custom for a long time. And now Rachel had taken the teraphim, that is, those idols, and put them in the saddle of the camel, you know, deceitful all the way to the end, to hide them from her father, and sat upon them. Because she still is with that superstition that if he finds the gods, you know, he might do them harm because his gods would help him. And on the other hand, she wanted those gods so she would have something to worship. After all, she was raised all her life believing in those idols, along with the knowledge of the God of Abraham, the God of heaven. And that's always an unfortunate problem that the children of Israel always had. So when you read the history of Israel later on, and you wonder, you know, why is it that they are so soon removed from the worship of the only God into idolatry? Well, you would realize that idolatry has always been a fact of life for them. And they have never departed from that, and they have never come clean out of it totally. That's what Babylon was all about to begin with. They worshipped the God of heaven. They knew about the God of heaven. They obeyed his laws, many of his laws, and then they also believed in other gods. And that's confusion, because the others are not gods. And so that was a part of the confusion that God always, to this very day, tells his people, come out of Babylon. You know, too many people to this very day have many gods, even though they don't realize it. And so he comes out, in other words, so she hides it, you know. And Laban felt about all the tents, so he's searching very diligently, can't find any. I mean, he knew that they stole them because they disappeared. Because the first thing he does, he runs to his gods to ask for help, and he doesn't find them, so he knows who took it. And so she said to her father, and he knew that Jacob basically would not be the one to do it, but maybe he did, he's not sure. And she said to her father, that is Rachel, let not my lord be angry that I cannot rise up before you, for the manner of women is upon me. In other words, she was going through her cycle, and therefore that's a time to sit and not stand up. And so obviously he did not even conceive of the fact that she might be sitting right on top of it. For the simple reason that people who worship those gods never did things like that. And so that made him believe that she was not. You see, that did not even occur to him that anybody would ever sit on gods in that manner. You know, that's defilement, even from their point of view, and profanity. And so he couldn't find the teraphim. And Jacob was wroth, angry, and strove with Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, what is my trespass? What is my sin? That you have hotly pursued after me. You see, he knew he came with anger and with the intent to harm him. Verse 37, whereas you have felt about all my stuff, you know, you're searching me as if I'm a criminal, what have you found of all your household stuff? You know, I haven't stolen anything, so why do you treat me as a criminal, you know, like they do when you go through the customs? Sometimes they treat you as a criminal when you haven't done anything wrong, just because they suspect something. So he said, set it here before my brethren and your brethren, that they may judge between us too. Now, in other words, if I've stolen anything, well, let's have all these people be witnesses between me and you. So now he says, this 20 years I have been with you. And as we mentioned earlier, when Jacob arrived at this point, he was about 70, 71 or so, maybe a bit, at least 70. And he was there for 20 years. And that was a period of time. So at this time he's about 90. Because when Joseph was born, he was 91, and we know that very well, because when Jacob was 130, this is when he came to Egypt, Joseph was at the time 39. And so obviously, you look, you know, you go back, and Jacob was, when he was born, Isaac, that is, when Joseph was born, Jacob was 91. And so shortly after that, when Jacob, in essence, was still a little child, he left. So here, he must be about 92, 93. And Laban, obviously, you're talking about his father-in-law, so Laban, obviously, is older than him. And either older than him or his age, whatever. But both of them, you know, centenarian, in essence, almost. This 20 years, he said, I have been with you. Thy ewes and your she-goats have not cast their young. In other words, I took care of your flock. I was very good to you. I did everything, you know, for you, you know, so you shouldn't have anything against me. You should be, you know, filled with gratitude, and all that you earned anyway was because of my work, not your own. And so he says, the rams of your flocks I have not eaten. I was always above board, never deceived you. I was honest. And of course, those are lessons that Jacob was learning also. He says, that which was torn of beast I brought not unto you. I bore the loss of it. Of my hand did you require it. In other words, when something like that happened, you, in essence, actually even required it from me. And that's how you treated me. And whether stolen by day or stolen by night, you couldn't care less. You wanted an account, and I had to give it to you from my own property. And so he says, thus I was in the day, the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. Now remember, earlier we were reading of the love, that is, that Jacob had for Rachel, and it says that he served for her 7 years. And yet because he loved her so much, it says that period of time went just like a few days, like a fleeting moment. And the idea was at the time is to comprehend the concept of the first love, that when you love so much, even though a long time goes by, even though you have to give much, even though you're going through suffering and pain, whatever it may be, you see, you don't consider it as too much, as a burden, as a hard thing to do. And the people that love God with all their being and heart, no matter what amount of sufferings they go through in this life, when they do it, you know, as Paul said, whatever you do in this life, do it as unto the Lord. In other words, when people serve God, when they have problems, if they complain, if they feel angry, if they're upset with God, and a lot of, unfortunately, brethren, who call themselves brethren, you see, and are, but they've got a problem. You know, they don't have the first love. And because they don't, they complain, they feel angry, and then many feel angry with God. You know, they don't always like to say it that way, but they begin to depart from God. You know, they either stop praying, and gradually they continue that way, they totally forsake God. But the people that serve God with their whole being and heart, and the love, the first love is always there, no matter what they go through in this life, you see, they are willing to do it because they love God and they do not consider it as something too much to do for God. They are willing to go even all the way to the end. And the apostles considered it an honor, you know, to be crucified or to be killed or to be martyred for the name of God. And so it's ironic that many people who have this kind of feeling to this very day are found in foreign religions. In Islam, they consider it a great honor to be a martyr, you know, to give their life for the sake of God. You know, from their own point of view, that's the way they see it. And yet many in our midst who are all the people of God, who have the Spirit of God, when we have difficulties and problems, you know, the first thing we do is we complain, we bellyache, and many of us turn against God. And harbor, you know, evil thoughts against him and depart from him. And you know, a lot of people, if they have departed from God, if they've departed from Jesus Christ to this very day, if they don't believe that Christ is God and the divine being, it is because of this very problem. They have forsaken their first love. And when things went wrong in their lives, every single one of them, you could see every single one of them were in this predicament. Things didn't go well in their lives, so gradually they begin in their heart to speak evil of God without even realizing it, And then it becomes a reality, and then you can see the consequences. They forsake him. And yet, this is what Jacob is explaining here. Though, you know, earlier the description was that he loved her so much that he did not even consider that the 7 years, just a few days. And yet he's explaining here, no, it was not an easy time as I went through that period. Even though I loved her so very much, you have to realize what I went through. And so that's what he's saying here. In verse 40, thus I was in the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. Oh, those were 7 tough years, you see. And Jacob was not used to it, even though he was a shepherd before that. But he was responsible for all these things. And that area there was not as pleasant as the land of Canaan. It was much colder there. And, you know, it was mountainous area. And so he really suffered through that period of time. And yet because of his love toward Rachel, it went like a few days. And so he says, these 20 years, verse 41, have I been in your house? I served you 14 years for your 2 daughters. Now, 7 years I did it with my whole being and heart. The other 7 years for, you know, well, the 4 years he did it for Rachel. Now, that's the irony of it here. The 7 first year he did it for Rachel. With his whole being and heart he did it, and because he loved her, he did not even consider those 7 years, just a few days. And the irony of it, because he was cheated, you know, in essence, Laban there was stealing his heart, deceiving him, outwitting him. He now had to work another 7 years for Rachel. See, he didn't work another 7 years for Leah. He already had Leah. You know, he got her for, you know, without doing anything, just being deceived. But now he has to work twice, you know, that period of time of 7 years. So it's another 7 years, and because he loved her very much, well, that 7 years also went like a few days. You see, that's what first love will do. You totally ignore the suffering, the pain, the anguish, the agony that you go through. And you see that example, for an instance, when you think and consider, especially if you know what they really go through, all those Olympians, you know, in other words, the people that go for the Olympics, for the gold medal, what they put their body through in order to achieve that. And because the love, so to speak, for fame and glory and gold medal, you know, all things that perish, whatever it may be, a lot of people are willing to sacrifice and do an awful lot, and other people do it for their children, or whatever, you know, worthy goal they have, whatever it may be. And instead of concentrating on the pain and suffering they go through and becoming miserable, they concentrate on the joys that are ahead of them. That was the ultimate that was fulfilled by our Savior and Creator and Redeemer, because of the joy that was ahead of him. You see, he despised the sufferings of the cross. And people that don't think that way, that do not have the first love, you know, toward the goal that is ahead of us, we have problems in this lifetime when, you know, we bellyache and complain and grumble and say, I can't take it anymore, and people leave God, or they leave the truth, or they leave the brethren, whatever it may be, or they get offended. That's what the problem is. Not so with Jacob. And not so with the people that really serve God with their whole being and heart. Nothing that happens to them in this life, as Paul would say, I came to recognize that nothing on this earth, you know, whatever suffering may come, you know, all that is not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be ahead of us. And that's what the first love is all about. And so another occasion for us to consider that and hopefully learn something from it. That's a study of the law. And then, and so he's saying here, for 20 years I've been with you in your house. I served you 14 years for your 2 daughters. You know, it was for 2 daughters, but in essence it was for Rachel, because that's the way he was basically doing it, 7 years for Rachel, and then he had to do it another 7 years for Rachel. But he said, for your 2 daughters, and 6 years for your flock. And you have changed my wages 10 times. You know, it's an idiom for you have deceived me many times. You know, every time I told him, let's do it this way, he said, okay. And after that, when you see that I am on top and you are not, you know, you say, well, let's change the rules of the game. That's in essence what he's saying here. So he tells you an awful lot about Laban, but then he tells you an awful lot about how God dealt with Jacob. You see, oftentimes we don't realize what we are until God makes us face, you know, somebody who looks just like us and acts just like us, you know, sort of, you know, look in the mirror and see yourself. And so when he looked at Laban, he saw himself, and he hated that. And that's how God teaches us through suffering and pain and anguish and torment and agony and things that He takes away from us, whatever it may be, what we really are, we're made of. And it brings us to the point, you know, where we absolutely abhor ourselves, that is the bad that is in us, and we depart from one extreme to the other. We go from that evil that we were to the good that God is. And then He becomes the mirror. And so that's, in essence, it's a part of the story. God was teaching him a lesson and brought him to the point where he totally abhorred deceitfulness and stealing hearts, you know, and doing things the wrong way. And we must learn that, and reality is there is no other way for God to teach us to have His nature and His character but through pain and suffering and sorrow and grief and persecution. And so, as Paul would say, you know, it is through much persecution that we must enter into the kingdom. There is no other way. It's not that God enjoys afflicting us, but, you know, the only way, just like, you know, you get the gold, there is no other way to get gold but making go through the furnace, through the fire. Well, anyway, we're going to stop at this point. This is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people.